Senator Romney, first, for just representing the state of Utah and sacrificing your time to do that. I'm really proud of you and a lot of the work you've done, so I just want to say thanks. I wrote here in my notes just a few things I wanted to touch on really quick is thanks for your vote against Trump's emergency declaration. I'm all for border security, but I don't think the president, the executive branch, should be able to reappropriate money. So thank you for that vote. Thank you for your vote, as you said, runaway spending last week on the spending bill. I'm also all for disaster relief, but that should be appropriated with budget caps. I would say I was a little upset with your vote to change cloture rules, cutting down debate time from 30 hours to 2. As you said, the Senate is a more deliberate body. You've got to have bipartisan support. I think that just kind of guts minority rights even further regarding the judicial just appointments and stuff like that.
Should we stop there?
Yeah, I'm going to stop there.
I'll just mention a couple of things for those that are not familiar with it. Like you, I support building a border wall. And I just think it makes common sense to have a fence or some kind of structure that keeps people from being able to come into the country illegally. There are a number of other things I think we have to do to hopefully eliminate illegal immigration. I'm a fan of legal immigration. I do not want to cut it down. I was pleased the president put a program out that said let's have legal immigration with the same numbers as the past, but let's have people come into the country based on what we think they can contribute, the job skills they might have, hopefully they speak English and so forth. I thought that was the right approach. So that's number one. Number two, with regards to the emergency declaration for wall funding, I do agree with you. I'm in favor of providing the money necessary for the wall, but thought that calling it an emergency, even though it is, there's no question it's a crisis, but using that as a tool to get funding was not the constitutional approach that I favored. I favor instead the appropriation coming from Congress, and Congress has provided money, and he can use money to provide the wall, and I'll vote for additional funding to make sure we do complete the wall as possible. With regards to the time to get judges in place, and this is kind of a strange setting, but what happens is that someone gets nominated to be a judge, a district judge, like here for Utah, we need a district judge in the federal court. The way it works is you have all sorts of hearings that go on for a long time. Both senators from the state have to approve of that judge for him to go forward, and that's just a convention. So, I mean, meaning it's not in law, but both senators have to agree. And then after you've had the hearings in the Judiciary Committee, then it goes to the Senate floor. And in the Senate floor, you can have a filibuster that goes on for 30 hours, all right? The challenge is that, I mean, there are only so many hours in a week. So for each district judge, you can go for 30 hours before you actually have a vote to say yes or no. And what had happened is that our friends on the other side of the aisle were sort of copying some of the things we did to them when they were in charge, which is drawing everything out for 30 hours. And so in a typical week, you could only get a couple of judges through. And so we reduced the time to 2 hours for the filibuster before you have the vote. And that means that we can get several judges through per week. We have almost 100 judges that are waiting to be voted on, up or down. So we still get the up or down vote, but we shorten the time just to be able to get more judges in place. And by the way, we're happy to, if the Democrats have control of the Senate in 2 years or 4 years or 6 years, we're happy to have the decisions made in two hours as opposed to having these long 40-hour, actually it was 30-hour, a 30-hour discussion or filibuster. So let's move on with the progress that we possibly can. Any other comment or question you wanted to ask me on that before you move on?
Not bad. And then I was just going to say, the moderate Republican myself, I appreciate your efforts on climate, because I'm a huge skier, and just seeing winters shorten, which is a statistical fact, I like seeing that.
No question, it's getting hotter, and Lindsey Graham and I are working on a piece of legislation to try and deal with technology and provide a an incentive for private enterprises and universities to look for ways to reduce global warming. I said to Lindsay, I don't know if humans are causing global warming, but I hope so. Because if we're not causing it, then there's no hope. It's just out of our control. I hope we have some impact so we can do something to make a difference. But I've seen nothing so far that suggests we can reduce the growth in the greenhouse gases, because as China and India and Brazil and Indonesia become more and more industrialized with automobiles and washing machines and air conditioners like we have, and they have the right to have those things like we do, why the energy usage keeps going up and up and up, and the CO2 keeps going up and up and up. And I think the only real solution to this problem is a technological breakthrough of some kind. And a number of enterprises are working on those kinds of things, so that's probably where I'm going to focus. Yes, sir, right here.
Senator, first I want to thank you for coming today, and I appreciate it. And I know your time is important. I have two questions, both two issues I'd like to address. Number one, you spoke about immigration. I'd like to know your thoughts on what we should do with the DACA population. The second question goes to climate change. And recently I've read a good deal about how this administration is allowing the EPA to change the methodology and what they want to allow the public to see in terms of going forward with climate projections. And supposedly the plan is only to limit climate protections to the year 2040, when things will be pretty stable. And after 2040 or 2050, the effects of climate change will sort of snowball and get much worse. And I wonder what you plan to do about that.
Well, let's see. What should we talk about with regards to immigration? What's your, pardon?
DACA.
Oh, yeah, our DACA individuals. My own view is that the DACA individuals should be allowed to stay in the country, to be given legal status in the country. If they want to become citizens, they should apply like other people that want to become citizens of the U.S. Presumably, they'd be pretty high in the line because they would speak English, they would have a high school degree in most cases, and they would have skills, particularly those that have already gotten jobs. So they'd move under the president's plan to base citizenship on and immigration, legal immigration, based upon those that merit-based, they would move to the very top of the line. But I would allow them to stay in the country legally, apply for citizenship, and if they want to become citizens. So that's my view with regards to the DACA individuals. With regards to climate change, this is a real challenge for us, and I don't know specifically what the EPA guidelines are, how they're being changed. So I'm going to take your word for it. My own view is I want as much information as we can possibly get. I would like us to hold the feet to the fire of the EPA with regards to auto emissions. I mean, I want our auto emissions to come down. I want the CAFE requirements that were put in place to be kept in place and not relaxed. Look, if you live along the Wasatch Front, as a huge share of our population does, we want the air as clean as we can possibly get it. So the more information we can get, the better. And the tighter we can put controls on automobiles and trucks and tractors and everything else, the better.
And what about coal?
Coal represents 70% of the power in our state. And that's not going to change anytime soon. It is going to change at some point, and we'll move increasingly to natural gas, probably not nuclear, but probably to natural gas. I would not make coal illegal. Basically, what we're seeing right now is market dynamics playing out. I let the market play as it has, and you're going to see the transfer from coal to natural gas. We're going to be sending our coal to other countries that will keep using it. Globally, our coal happens to be some of the cleanest coal, and there are a lot of nations that use coal and will for a long period of time. So I'd send our coal to markets where, because we have such clean coal, it would be widely accepted. Yes, ma'am.
I have two questions in regards to Robert Mueller's statement earlier today.
Uh-huh.
First, at the conclusion of that statement, I understand that our president considers the case closed. Do you view it in that way? Do you see this as a wrapped-up situation, or are you in favor of further evaluation of the situation?
Let me step back and just describe sort of how I see it, and maybe I'm oversimplifying, but I look at Robert Mueller's investigation a bit like the police on Law and Order. We've all seen Law and Order, right? They do the investigation, they gather the facts, they gather the evidence. Then there's the prosecutor. Now, normally the prosecutor would be in the Justice Department, but as Robert Mueller indicated, a president can't be indicted under Justice Department policy, so the Justice Department is not the prosecutor in this case. The prosecution would be led by the House of Representatives, or Speaker Pelosi. And then there's the jury, and the jury is the Senate. And so Robert Mueller provided the evidence, and now it's up to the prosecutor to decide, and that's Speaker Pelosi and the House, whether they want to prosecute. My own view is that making a case for obstruction of justice is particularly difficult if there hasn't been found an underlying crime. Not impossible, but more difficult, particularly if you're trying to prove intent. And so I think that Speaker Pelosi is likely to reach a conclusion that she will not pursue an indictment, or not an indictment, but an impeachment. I think she would also make the decision in part based upon what she thinks the jury's going to do. And if she sees a jury that's not inclined to vote to convict, if you will, she's less likely to bring it forward. And likewise, the public at large. I think the public at large is not in favor of removing the president on the basis of what they've seen so far. So I think my own view is that the prosecutor in this case would have a hard time making an effective case for impeachment and removal from office. But that decision is going to be up to her. And she and the House have a responsibility to review the Mueller investigation, to carry out whatever investigation they think they need to, and to make that decision. And if I become part of the jury, I'll listen to what they have to say. But my own view is based upon what I've seen, that an impeachment is not the course that is going to end in the results you wanted.
The second part of my question is, at the end of his statement, I took away the message of his great concern for Russian involvement in the 2016 election.
Absolutely.
And the ongoing issues with the Russians. What is Congress doing, since there seems to be in the executive branch of government less concern for that issue? What is Congress doing to help us to protect our democracy and our elections?
The House of Representatives has put together, I think it's H.R. 1, their first bill, which lays out all sorts of provisions, which they have tried to find ways to prevent foreign involvement in campaigns. They've also added a lot of other things to it, a lot of bells and whistles that makes it very unattractive to Republicans. So their bill, as is unlikely to be successful in the Senate. The Senate hopefully will come up with its own effort to say, how do we protect our election system from foreign interference? And I'm looking at a bill that is being spearheaded by Mark Warner, along with others, that I'm studying carefully, that is focused on providing transparency as to who is trying to influence elections and who is putting ads on social media. And identifying specifically. So for instance, right now, if you watch TV and there's an ad for a politician, it says who it is that's behind that ad. You remember, I'm Mitt Romney and I approve this message. But if you go on social media, that's not the case. So this is a bill that would provide on social media the same requirement, which is whoever's paying for it would have to be identified in the ad. And I'm positively inclined, although as Ross Perot used to say, the devil's in the details, and so I'm working on that. But that's probably what the Senate will come out with. And then hopefully the two will come together with some kind of a middle ground reached. Yeah, thank you. Yes, sir.
Yeah, my name is Gary Shepard.
Detroit man.
Yes,
wow, look at that.
My wife and I just moved from your home state, the great state of Michigan.
I was born in Michigan, yes. Yeah. Still kind of a Detroit Tigers fan, but that's after being a Red Sox fan. Red Sox first, Tigers second. Yeah.
We'll allow that. We made the agreement with the Solid Bees.
They don't compete, but I'm happy to be a fan too.
Right. So I'd like to just revisit the Mueller report and the impeachment issue. When the Mueller report first came out, you read what you could read, and you said that you were sickened by what you found in that report. as you know, and I think everyone else knows as well, that impeachment does not require an indictment of crime. And so I think you also said later, after you made your initial comment, that you didn't feel as though the evidence that you had seen, even though it was sickening to you, rose to the level of impeachment. So I'm wondering, what would rise to the level of impeachment?
There are many impeachable offenses, and one could come up with. I'm not saying in the Mueller report. I'm just saying generally, presidents can do all sorts of things that would suggest impeachment. And I don't know that it's helpful to list them. But to find obstruction of justice, you need to find intent to obstruct a probe into a criminal act, and that, in my view, is difficult to prove when there's not been sufficient evidence of a criminal act. And that's why I said I don't think that's a course that the prosecution, in this case Nancy Pelosi, ought to take. I did indicate that I was sickened, and that's in part because of the dishonesty. All right, and now, it's not a crime to lie. It's just wrong. And I'm sorry, I think it's morally wrong, and I reject people who lie, and I reject lies. And by the way, I've said things that were wrong, and I try and correct them when I do. But it's not a crime to misstate the truth. And there were things said in that report which suggested that people in the administration had said things that were untrue. And I found that disheartening, because I expect total honesty by the highest office in the land. And if they make a mistake and say something that's untrue, I expect them to come out and say, I made a mistake, and clarify it. And so I was disturbed by that, and wished there were greater effort on many people's part, but in the administration in particular, to hold close to the truth. You have a follow-up.
Yeah, Republicans impeach President Clinton for lying.
Under oath, though. That was per se. That is illegal, because he was under oath.
Well, can I speak, please? Again, obstruction of justice and indictable crimes, I don't think they're the only criteria. I mean, you're talking about lying as something that you don't accept, and yet lying, okay, if we ever, some of these people did lie under oath, apparently.
With regards to the president, he was not interviewed under oath. He did not. He did not. So far as I've seen,
he submitted responses to the question.
Yes, he did. And I didn't see in the Mueller report, and I have read the Mueller report. I'm one of the few who's read all two volumes, 450 some odd pages. I did not see anything in the Mueller report that indicated that they thought that something that had been said by the president was untruthful in that report. There are a number of things where they felt there are a number of pieces of evidence that they suggest is troublesome, but they don't suggest something that relates to perjury or something of that nature. In the case of President Clinton, that was a different setting. I mean, we are a nation of laws. And if someone breaks a law, then we take action consistent with removal. But people going on the air and telling untruths, or being on an airplane and being asked by a reporter a question and answering untruthfully, does not result in a crime being prosecuted, even though it's something which I find disheartening, at the least. Yes, sir.
With all due respect, the idea that every single person around the president can lie, and many of them to the FBI, and many of them to Congress, but the president himself is not responsible for the actions of his people, and we're not responsible for holding him accountable, that to me seems to be not doing your duty as the House and the Senate. The thing to me that really bothers me about Trump is his attacks on the intelligence community, his attacks on law enforcement, his attacks on, every most of the institutions that I think we hold dear as Americans. And it bothers me that Republicans in the House and in the Senate let that happen.
Well,
and don't, and don't, and do not, you know, they're letting him attack Mueller. I mean, Mueller's a Vietnam vet, for goodness sakes. He's one of the best American heroes we have in terms of, you know, all the things you can get when you serve in the military. He, you know, took bullets in Vietnam and went back, unlike Trump. I want to understand why Republicans in the House and Senate do not more forcefully defend Mueller's investigation and call for Trump's impeachment. I support Trump's impeachment. I think it should be impeached. I've seen enough.
I would note that I can't speak for other Republicans in the House and the Senate, as you know, but I speak for myself. And if I find something which I think is untruthful and in a significant way divisive of the country, I will speak out on it. That doesn't necessarily make me popular in all quarters. I'm in an unusual position, which is I'm not terribly favored on the right, nor terribly favored on the left, all right? Because I'm not calling for impeachment, so people on the left aren't happy, and I'm not willing just to go along with anything the president says, so people on the right aren't necessarily happy. I just saying exactly what I believe, and my own view is that if the president says something of a significant nature, which I think is divisive and damaging to the country, I will speak out on it, and have, and do that on a pretty regular basis, where that's occurred. With regards to impeachment, I've offered my thoughts about the prosecutor, in this case it's the House, and what I think the House will do, or how they'll evaluate the evidence. But if they decide to impeach, I'll be a member of the jury. I will not be the prosecutor, I'll be a member of the jury. The Senate is the jury, and I will listen to what is brought forth and offer my most honest and fair assessment as any juror would do. Okay. Yes, sir, right here.
Spencer Webb, Utah, born and raised, graduated from Skyline High School, attended Brigham Young University. I'm representative of the online community for Reddit called McDonald. 700,000 members, 12,000 currently online waiting to hear a report from this meeting. I have a question because you brought this up in China, and it involves election integrity on two elements, domestic and foreign. You mentioned foreign. I'm concerned not about Russia. I'm concerned about one of the heads of the foreign intelligence committees, Diane Feinstein, having had a Chinese spy on her staff for 10 years. Now, if this had been a Russian, I would empathize a lot with everyone else in this room. But so my question is on the foreign part, what are you going to do to ensure that China, which owns Apple and Facebook and Google and Hollywood, is just creeping in and threatening to stop rare earth mineral exports, as I understand? And on the domestic standpoint, I am concerned about Hillary Clinton rigging the primary against Bernie Sanders. I didn't support Bernie Sanders, and I didn't support Hillary Clinton. But I think we have a major problem with elections. If we can't look at the primaries being rigged, and the last thing I want to ask is a question. In the 2012 election about the primaries and integrity, it was reported by Rachel Maddow and John Stewart did bits about it and a number of people. He asks, what are we doing? Well, I'm working. I'm getting informed and involved. What are you doing? I'm not trying to make you be responsible for this, Senator, but it was reported that Ron Paul won the primary in Iowa, Florida, Maine, and Minnesota. And it was reported, furthermore, that Carl Rove... Oh, please, Mr. Senator, let me finish the question.
Well, who reported that?
I'd be happy to file a report, a complete intelligence report for your staff, and submit it to you after this meeting, because I've got 12,000 people online ready to work on it. I didn't come here with a prosecution. I'd just like your response, sir, and this is very telling, to a lot of people that are very interested to know, were you involved with Carl Rove during the 2012 Republican primary, rigging the election against Ron Paul?
Tell me, how would you rig a primary?
The same way Hillary Clinton did it.
That's tautological. How would you rig a primary? I was in Iowa.
What did Carl Rove do? How did he show up to Iowa and find votes for you, sir? You talked about election integrity.
Wait,
I'm
wait,
not trying to
you
say
spoke. You spoke. You get your turn.
Following your example, right, sir. Interrupting.
Are you finished? Do you have more to say?
Following your example, sir.
Are you finished?
Following your example.
Well, my example. Now, I've listened. Are you ready to let me speak now?
Generally, when someone stops moving their mouth, sir, you can go ahead. You don't need to insult me and treat me like a
All right, next question.
Do you refuse to answer this question? I need to know the numbers and write it to me, sir.
First of all, the person who won the Iowa primary was Rick Santorum.
You couldn't beat Kennedy.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I get a chance
Trump
to speak.
Supports the next guy,
if you can't stop speaking, we're going to ask you to let someone else speak.
I'm working against you every election.
Well, good. Fine. Guess what? I'm in for 6 years.
I want you to know.
Let me respond. With regards to the primary, Rick Santorum won Iowa. I'll tell you, it was the saddest thing that happened to me because I won by 8 votes in the Iowa caucus, and then they did a recount, and he won by 12 votes. All right. So Rick Santorum won Iowa, I won New Hampshire. And Ron Paul, bless his heart, did not win any primaries. And I don't know how you would rig a primary, a caucus in particular. The caucuses, by the way, it's like this. I went to the Iowa caucuses, and it's really some people are in a room like this, and they say, how many vote for Romney? And they count hands. And how many vote for Santorum? They count hands. And how many vote for Ron Paul? So they count hands. That's how the Iowa caucuses are done. And we have people in every one of the places. And they had people in the places and counted hands, and it was pretty well done. They also fill out a paper copy as well. So anyway, there were a number of comments there. I am very concerned about China, and China will, without question, try and get involved in our electoral process, as is Russia. The Mueller report pointed out that Russia did indeed interfere in a significant way in our election, and they will try and do it again. I'm absolutely convinced that they're going to make an effort to be involved in the 2020 elections. They apparently tried in 2018, but weren't terribly effective in 2018, so far as we know. But, you know, the advent of social media opens a doorway for people to get involved and to, if you will, pull some strings. And that's a real problem to our democracy. And so how we're going to keep them from doing that is a real, real challenge. Glenn?
Senator, we love you. And I have a question that comes from my patriotism. I love this country. And it has troubled me over the last couple of years to hear the rising sentiment in the popular media and among some politicians advocating socialism. I don't understand it. We're one of the greatest countries in the history of the world. Our way of life is unique. We've been a shining example in the world through time. Why do we have this sentiment of socialism, and what can we do about it?
Well, there are probably two definitions in mind. One is the real definition of socialism, which is a government-owned, the government owns the production resources of a nation, all right? And I don't know that even Bernie Sanders is asking for that. But what he's looking for is the government basically running major aspects of our life, including our health care, which is that there would be a national health care system where everybody would have Medicare. It's Medicare for all. By the way, for you seniors who've been paying all, and I'm a senior too on Medicare, we've been paying all of our lives, every pay period for Medicare. Can you imagine now being told, oh, by the way, it's being given to everybody for free. You paid for it all your life, but now it's going out free to everybody. And you have Medicare and your doctor and your system, not everybody's getting Medicare. And the cost would be extraordinarily high. But that's a, if you will, a socialistic approach, which is the government is now going to tell the private market, the private insurance companies, you're going away and the government's going to step in. That's kind of a different definition of socialism than the government owning the means of production. But it's a form of socialism that a lot of people find attractive. I frankly find it antithetical to the way America has worked. And I know Bernie looks around for a place to point to that says, look how well it's working. And they typically look at Scandinavia and say, look, it's working there. It's working in Sweden. Well, take a closer look at Sweden. All right, the average Swedish individual earns about one quarter less than the average American. All right, so it's not like, oh, they're much richer, they're doing much better. No, we're doing better. We're the most powerful nation on the earth. We have this extraordinary growing economy. Our economy, by the way, is growing faster than any other developed nation that I know of in the world. So our system's working pretty darn well. So I look with great askance when the Bernie Sanders of the world comes and says, look, we want to have the government take something over. By the way, have you watched this thing on HBO called Chernobyl? There's this series right now called Chernobyl. I mean, you see what happens in a setting where the government runs things. It just doesn't work terribly well. The funny thing is, it looks good on paper. If you said, look, which is a better system? If a Martian were to come down, we were to say to a Martian, look, we got two models we can choose. One is we can have some of our smartest people tell everybody what to do, get them in the right job, tell them what to make sure that everybody has what they need. That's a socialist model. Or we can have another model where we don't tell anybody anything. We set the rules, but let everybody run off and do what they want to do. Which is going to work better? Well, the Martian's going to say the first one's going to work better. But history has shown it doesn't work at all. The system that works, the system that has dominated the world and brought people out of poverty, is a system that says let free people choose their own course and make government as small as you possibly can, still setting the rules. It's got to be there. You can't just have, wild anarchy. Government has to set rules to make free enterprise work and capitalism work. But that's the right way to increase prosperity, to maintain freedom, and to have everybody better off. So, but we'll have differences, by the way, in a number of these programs and which is the right way to manage them. But by and large, if you look at the places in our economy run by government, they tend to be high cost and not terribly responsive to citizens. And if you look at things that are run by the private sector, they tend to have lower cost and to be more responsive to the consumer. And some things have to be run by government, our tax system, our military, our schools, but they tend to have more difficulties. So I'm not a fan of socialism, I gotta be honest. Thank you. Yes, sir, back there.
My name's Watson, I'm 17 years old. I just graduated from Wasatch last week. So I've had the opportunity to talk to Mayor Potter and Lieutenant Governor Cox this year in school. And two of the biggest questions that we've asked was, Governor Cox said that voter turnout from age 18 to 24 was under 30%. And I think that was a national average, but I can't actually remember. And he says that the way that we're supposed to increase voter turnout among young people is all the seniors, they have to take the government class senior year and pass a civics test, but people are arguing that that's not enough. So my question to you was, how do we get younger people to have a higher voter turnout? And not just that, but what you see more today is, how do we get those kids to be able to educate themselves as opposed to just looking at the media or following what the teachers say, which could be potentially biased in certain situations? So I just want to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, a couple things. One, the idea of a civics class, and that would not be a national requirement, but a state-by-state decision as to whether or not to have a class where people get a better sense of what voting means to them would make a lot of sense. Whether you want to have that as a test that you have to pass to graduate, that's, again, up to each state to decide. But I wouldn't be opposed to that idea. I think people think it's hard to register to vote. You know how easy it is to register to vote in our state? I mean, you just go to when you get your driver's license, they say, do you want to register to vote? You say, yes, bingo, you're registered. So, it's very easy to register to vote. So young people knowing that would be helpful. And then social media has the potential of encouraging people to get out and vote. I know there's some downsides to it as well, because it can be manipulated and lots of false stories and conspiracies can be spread. People just make stuff up and send it out. But it gets people energized. I wish I had the answer to this, because both parties try very hard to get people to turn out to vote. I mean, it's the centerpiece of a campaign, believe it or not. The big money we spend in a campaign is less and less on advertising, because there's not as much impact. Advertising doesn't seem to have as much impact on TV as it used to. We spend our money getting people out to vote and encouraging them to get and vote, because that makes the difference. And if Republicans can get our people to vote, why, we win. If Democrats can get their people to vote, then they win. So we're out there trying to get our people to vote. And young people, I mean, you're a key cohort, meaning you're key to winning elections. And if you get an idea, I'm all ears.
Can I have a follow-up question, too?
Sure.
So why do you think that people like Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, why do you think those people appeal more to young people with socialism? I think it's because of just how uneducated, or I wouldn't say uneducated, but how uninformed people can be. So I'd just like to hear your thoughts on that. Like, why do young people, because you hardly see any like senior citizens like advocating for Bernie Sanders and socialism, with maybe the exception of some places in California.
I'm not going to make that assessment and categorize people necessarily that way. There's some famous comments by Winston Churchill and others about that idea. But I can say that I think people who've been out in the real world and have looked around the world at what systems are working come to the conclusion that socialism generally is not a very effective economic model. I mean, by the way, China was just in the doldrums for well over a century because they had socialism and communism. And then they adopted free enterprise, not entirely, but a form of it. They've adopted free enterprise, and holy cow, look at their economy. They're growing like crazy. And they will, because their population is almost four times our size, someday their economy will be larger than ours. Unless there's some kind of disruption, or unless we do some things I'd like to see us do. But I mean, they've adopted free enterprise and pulled hundreds of billions of people out of poverty. Free enterprise works. And I think people look at socialism and say it doesn't work. And people who think, hey, I'd love to see Medicare for all, it's like, do you really want to have no option? I mean, literally, you can't have your own private insurance? Meaning that, I mean, what's it like when you call the IRS? Do you get the help that you need? Do you really want to have to deal with a government employee if you got a health care issue? I mean, right now, if you don't, you know, your employer may provide insurance for you. If you don't like that insurer, you can go to a different one, perhaps. Or you can drop them all together and buy insurance on your own with a health savings account. You have options. But if there's only one provider of insurance and it's the government, and you get some bureaucrat that turns you down for some procedure you want, I just can't imagine America sitting still for that. So, yeah, I
thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Senator,
let's just turn the red up here.
Time for one more question.
Thanks, Senator, being here. I want to move into the international realm.
Yeah.
You're chairman of Subcommittee of Foreign Relations, Subcommittee on Near East and South Asia and so forth.
Yeah, I'm the chairman of the committee that goes from Marrakesh to Bangladesh.
Yeah,
exactly. That whole area. Can you believe that? Yeah.
There's conflict going on in Yemen that is leaving children starving to death and dying of disease, as well as adults. And that conflict is being supported by our government. And I wonder what your position is on the government supporting that, and what you might be able to do as chair of that subcommittee, if you feel that is wrong, to change it.
I don't feel it's wrong. So that answers the second part of the question, but let me describe why. And that is this, which is a group of rebels in Yemen called the Houthi have gone after the government, have opposed the government, and began, if you will, a civil war, and have taken territory and are in battle with the government. Iran is backing the Houthis and providing them with technology, with armament, with now we understand drones as well, which they're using to go in and drop explosives on people. And this has been a brutal reality. Saudi Arabia looks and says, we don't want to have Iran take over Yemen. And Saudi Arabia, who's opposed to Iran, Saudi Arabia says, we're going to get on the side of the government and provide support to the government. And we're going to fight with the other side. So now we have the Houthis going up against Saudi Arabia. If you will, Iran and Saudi Arabia are faced off with their surrogates in Yemen. If either side just says, hey, we're leaving, well, then the other side just takes it over. And so the option of just saying, hey, we're not going to support the Saudis is not one I support, because I don't want to have Iran and the Houthis take over the country.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's fine.
But then I take it's your position that the solution to this is military, not a diplomatic solution.
Well, I hope what will happen is that there will be a recognition on the part of both Iran and Saudi Arabia that this can't go on forever, and that they'll come to a bargaining a negotiating table and agree to a ceasefire. That there will be territory that's either divided or a government that is compromised government, a combination government of some kind, but that they negotiate a settlement, hopefully as soon as possible. But there's no question that if the U.S. or if the Saudis were to say we're pulling out, why then the Houthis and the Iran basically have free run of the country, and that is something which I do not believe would be in the best interest of ourselves or our allies.
So you have a hope, but you don't see a solution in the near future.
Well, it's a bit like, I mean, I hate to make the comparison, but it's a bit like Afghanistan. It's like, okay, so we're in Afghanistan. We've been there for 18 years. And we got the Taliban, and we got us. And it is my hope that we will be able to successfully negotiate an agreement to settle things. I know there's an effort right now to do that. We're negotiating with the Taliban. But I would rather have a negotiated settlement than one where we just walk away and say, let's let happen what happens.
And so foreign relations and your subcommittee really have no role in that. That's really the administration and the State Department.
Actually, the committee does have some role, but foreign policy is primarily directed by the administration,
right,
and by the State Department, and not by Congress. That being said, Congress has the power of the purse.
Exactly.
So we have the capacity, were we to feel this was important, we have the capacity to say to the president, you can't sell any more weapons to the Saudi Arabia. All right, we're not going to let you, not going to authorize you to do that. We're not going to provide the funds for that. So Congress does have that capacity. And so we have influence with the power of the purse to do those kinds of things. I'm not saying I want to do those things, but we do have that power. And in some places, we will exercise that power. And that's been, as you know, that's been an area of battle over the last several weeks.
The House has passed a joint resolution calling for the United States military to stop supporting this country.
Right.
And that's been passed now to the Senate. It sits in the foreign relations docket, if you will. Do you have any sense of whether Chairman Graham is going to act on that, or is it just going to die sitting there?
It will, if it's acted upon, it'll be voted down, because the Republicans, by and large, myself included, support the administration's policy of providing targeting weapons to the Saudi Arabians, so they can reduce the number of civilian casualties associated with their battle against Iran and the Houthis.
All right, thank you.
Let's see. Yes, sir.
Last question.
I'm on Medicare, and I rather like that socialist program. You mentioned the cost, that we can't afford to have universal health care for everyone. The cost per capita in the U.S. is higher than any other nation in the world, almost by a factor of two. Yet our medical outcomes are mediocre at best in terms of longevity, infant mortality, maternal mortality. Why are you against a program that can reduce our costs and increase the results of the healthcare of Americans?
Very good question, and I would tell you this, which is going to an all-government system with no private insurers, in my opinion, would mean it gets much more expensive, not less expensive. That's part one. So I believe an all-government system will become massively more expensive. That's one. Number two, we have dramatically better care in this country than do other nations. In part, you want to get an MRI in Great Britain? I mean, if you have prostate cancer in Great Britain at age 70, you don't get surgery. Not an option for you. You're also not going to get an MRI. We have 10 times as many MRI machines in the United States per capita as Canada does. So you want to get an MRI here, you've got a bad headache and you're concerned that maybe that fall you had has resulted in a hematoma. You can get an MRI here in a day or two. Try and do that in Canada. You're not going to be able to do that. I'm not a doctor. Did I use the right term? All right. So we have the capacity to have far better treatment, in my opinion, than do many other places in the world. But again, that's going to be a matter of opinion. I can tell you, you paid 107. If you're an average senior citizen, you paid $170,000 to get Medicare over your lifetime. That's the average senior citizen. That got taken out of your paychecks, $170,000. So what I can tell you is, if we're now going to give that not just to people 67 and older, but to the entire population, we got to come up with a lot of money. Basically, at least $170,000 a person. And so this it's it, the cost of healthcare is a huge expense. There's no question we spend more than others do, in part because we get a lot more healthcare than others do. You have a follow up?
Okay. Yeah. We spend a little bit over $10,000 per person per year. It's roughly $3.5 trillion total. You mentioned that the health care in these other countries that have universal health care are not equal to ours, but can you give any demonstrable quantitative evidence to support that? I can give you the infant mortality, I can give you maternal mortality, and I can give you longevity, in which we are not as good as these other countries. Can you give me any stats that say we are better than these other countries to justify our much higher expenditures?
Well, the evidence I can give you is that almost anyone I know that gets a serious illness wants to come to the United States of America to get treated. One of the challenges we have, and this may be unfair, but we have some lifestyle issues in our country that account for some of those statistics. All right? Have we looked around at our respective waistlines and looked at how much sugar we eat? And how? I was told when I was growing up that if I cut back on fats, I wasn't going to get a heart attack. So I ate no fat. All right, no cheese, no butter, skim milk only. I was almost perfect in staying away from fat, but I substituted sugar for fat. All right, so I ate all sorts of sugar stuff. Now they tell us, no, it's not sugar, it's not fat that's bad, it's sugar that's bad, all right? So I've lived an unhealthy lifestyle. I'm afraid a lot of Americans, we don't live the kind of lifestyle we should. So I think you'd have to adjust for some of those things to be able to make a comparison on an entire population. But I take your point. I'm happy to research it and to look at the data, but gosh, I mean, Vermont has a chance to do this. All right? My own view, by the way, here's how I'd do it, which is I'd say let each state do it their own way. Take the money that you get from the government, take the money that you send to government for Medicaid and for Obamacare, and send it back to the state. Say you get your money back. And if you want to go to a single-payer system, a Medicare-type system, be my guest. But let each state do their own. Now, Vermont took a look at it and said, holy cow, it's way too expensive. We can't possibly get there. But if they got their federal money back, perhaps they'd come to a different decision. But my own view is that competition tends to work better. And I do want those choices. There's a young lady, I'm told I've taken you long enough. He's saying, no more. I'll take one more question from a very enthusiastic young woman in the back row.
My name is Christy Jensen. I'm a Waterford teacher.
Uh-huh.
Are you aware that the United Nations is having a meeting here in August in Salt Lake City?
Wonderful. I was not aware of that.
About economic sustainability issues. Are there things we could do with the United Nations when they're here in Utah that you think would be helpful to do with sustainability and community environmental issues?
I'd love to get their perspectives on what things we can do better, particularly how we can manage the pollution that's going into the air. And something else which I know we don't talk about very much. We take great pride in how fast our state is growing. We're the fastest growing state in America in terms of population, in terms of jobs. Very impressive. We're very proud of that. How much growth do we want?
How much
growth? How much growth do we want?
Done.
So one of the questions I think and this, by the way, this is not for the Senate. All right, I'm just talking as a Utah citizen and resident. How much growth do we want? Because the faster we grow, we need more roads, we'll need more water, more sewage treatment plants, and by the way, we'll put more stuff up in the air. So how much do we want? And by the way, we want good jobs coming here, no question. We want better jobs and higher pay, better wages. But what kinds of companies do we want coming? Is it just anybody who wants to come here? Or do we want to be a little more selective and say, these are the kinds of jobs we want to come to our state? I was governor of another state. I was governor of Massachusetts. Massachusetts doesn't have land, open land like Utah does. So there weren't new developments going in, new homes being built. The only way you could get a home was buy an existing home. And if you wanted to make it new, you had to tear it down. So the state doesn't grow. And yet it has the highest incomes in the country, and by the way, the number one schools in the country. So growth doesn't necessarily mean incomes going up and wages going up and education getting better. So I think this is a question. You got people coming here from other places. Ask them about growth. What's their advice on growth? What things should we do? I like the fact that Utah Lake seems to be getting lower. All right? We're using a lot of water. I want Utah Lake to be nice and full. You realize if it goes lower and lower and lower, you won't have as much snow because the lake effect snow won't be. Who's the skier here who made that question? There you go. Lake effect snow will be affected. And by the way, if it gets too low, you're going to have dust coming up from the area around the lake. And I don't know what the heck is in that dust in Utah. Excuse me, Utah Lake as well. But in the Great Salt Lake, I wouldn't want that dust. So these are questions, these growth questions are questions that the state has to face and that the nation, as a nation, we need to face. Our population as a nation is going down. Fortunately, we have legal immigration that allows us to maintain our population or grow it slowly, which allows our economy to grow. But these are questions I think I had some folks from other nations here. I'd like to get their perspective. You guys, thank you for being so respectful and offering such good advice and questions. I deem it a real honor to serve. I will be making my first speech in the Senate next week when I get back. I think June 4th is the date. And I'll be speaking about matters that we care about. But in particular, I'll be talking about foreign policy and what's happening there, because there's not a lot of attention being focused on that. But tune in on C-SPAN. By the way, one of the interesting things about the Senate is that once they got cameras, I know there was a big debate whether they were going to allow cameras into the Senate. They didn't want to have the live cameras there. So now we have cameras. What that has meant is that you could sit in your office and not have to go to the floor and listen to what people are saying. So when you watch someone on TV, a senator giving a speech, hope you recognize there's not one of the senator in the room. All right. There's nobody there. There's someone sitting in the chair. I'm exaggerating because there's a presiding officer sitting in the chair, and they call him the president, because he's the president of the Senate, he or she, as long as they're in that chair. And there's some staff there, and there's some interns that are helping out, some pages that are helping out. But there are no other senators there. And so I'll be giving my speech to an empty room. I'll act like there's a huge crowd there, but don't expect applause because there won't be any. My wife and a few friends will be in the balcony listening in. But it's good to be here with you. I love getting the chance to see you. I can only promise you this. I will, with all my energy, abide by my most profound principles and beliefs. I'll tell you exactly where I stand. You won't always agree with me. It's just in the nature of humanity that we have different points of view, but I will do everything in my power to serve with honor and integrity. Thanks so much. Good to be with you.
Excuse me, were you here at the beginning?